You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 13th of December 2018 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily in association with UBS. Live from Midori House in London, this is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up
today, we've said to the world that the United States Senate does not want the United States of America to be participating in the horrific Saudi-led intervention in the Yemen civil war.
Bernie Sanders and his fellow U.S. senators vote to stop abetting Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen. But does this probably symbolic vote mean anything, even if it doesn't change anything? Also ahead, French President Emmanuel Macron continues to struggle to connect with the common person from behind his big gold desk. China continues to express its anger at Canada's arrest of a Chinese executive by arresting Canadians. In Korea, the demilitarized zone becomes just a little bit less militarized, and we'll find out why Russian officials are struggling with this newfangled hip-hop music the kids are into. That's all coming up on the Monocle Daily, live from London, starting now. And welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Muller. To talk of good news emerging from Yemen is to admit that these things are relative. Nearly 4 years of war between a government backed by a Saudi-led coalition of foreign militaries and a rebel militia backed by Iran and also involving assorted jihadi groups has left tens of thousands dead, hundreds of thousands displaced, millions at threat of starvation. However, agreement has been reached to at least pause the fighting for the port city of Hodeidah, currently held by the Houthi rebels. This breakthrough follows a week of talks in Sweden. I'm joined now by Elizabeth Kendall, Senior Research Fellow in Arabic at Pembroke College, Oxford. Elizabeth, it's tempting to welcome any breakthrough where Yemen is concerned as a big breakthrough, because there haven't really been any. But how big a thing is this really?
Well, you put it very appropriately there. It is a big deal because we have not had the warring sides speak face to face, let alone shake hands in public for over 2 years. So shake hands in public for four years. So this is really a big deal. But you're right also to be cautious. I think at the start of these talks, we were just pleased that the Houthis had showed up, that the talks continued, that they didn't break down, that they went on for a week, and that a prisoner exchange was agreed. And then today we got this news that a ceasefire had also been agreed, this elusive ceasefire for Hodeidah. This is, of course, the main port through which supplies, aid, food, medicine enters Yemen. So it's crucial to stave off mass starvation. So I think today everyone can just catch their breath and be pleased that some progress has been made.
So what do we glean from the fact that after all these years of fighting and after all these years of not even talking about stopping fighting, everybody was willing to agree to this ceasefire in this place? Is there a bit of weariness beginning to set in on both sides and understanding that a decisive military solution is not really an option?
It does seem that it's finally dawning on the two main warring sides that a military solution is not possible to this war. It's been going on for very close to 4 years. It was supposed to be a quick war over in a matter of weeks. And so at this particular point in time, two positions have collided. One is that Saudi Arabia, who leads the military coalition that's supporting the fallen government trying to take back its land from the Houthi rebels, is probably at the most unpopular it's ever been, partly owing to the Saudi murder of Jamal Khashoggi, and partly owing to much more press attention on the atrocities that have occurred during the war and the poor targeting that has occurred. But also, on the other hand, the Houthis, really their power has peaked. They're only going to go downhill from here. They lost a major ally a year ago when the former president was killed by them after being about to defect. So both sides now, I think, realize that there have to be some steps towards peace.
So in that context, does the vote today by the US Senate, which may, of course, be vetoed by President Trump and may, of course, not get through the House of Representatives, but does it tip any balance in any direction?
It tips the balance in the direction of the government of President Hadi, which is supported by Saudi Arabia, having to stand by this agreement, really. It's already in a very weakened position. And Saudi Arabia desperately needs to claw back some credibility on the international stage. This Senate vote today simply piles the pressure on. We have to hope that it actually works to make Saudi Arabia abide by the agreement that was signed today in Sweden.
How solid does this ceasefire look to you? That this is, of course, the problem with ceasefires, especially when they've been imposed after a long period of fighting, that fighting is what people on both sides have got used to, and often the reflexive reaction to any disturbance or any perceived threat is to let fly at it with the response that provokes a reaction, and here we go again. Is this one likely to stick?
Well, that's a very wise observation on your part. It's one thing to celebrate a handshake over an agreement in Sweden. It is quite another to make sure that this happens on the ground. So after everyone catches their breath and congratulates themselves on having reached some kind of agreement in Sweden, now comes the difficult part. And I think that trying to get people on the ground to abide by the ceasefire will be really hard. And the agreements that came out today from Sweden, I've read all of them, they are a little light on detail, and it's just a question of the committees that are put in place to monitor this ceasefire and the UN forces or UN supervision that is going to be put in place in Hodeidah Port. Can they manage to keep a grip on it? We just have to keep our fingers crossed that they can.
When you say they're a little light on detail, is there any detail in there about how this ceasefire will be monitored, enforced, if that's the word? Whose word are we going to be able to take on this?
Well, the United Nations is supposed to play a leading role in supervising this ceasefire, and the agreement actually refers to a strengthened UN presence in the city of Hodeidah and also the other two ports further north, which were also mentioned in the agreement. But, I mean, here's the rub. It's the agreement actually talks about a redeployment of the existing forces. So it doesn't talk about decommissioning them or demobilizing them. The Houthis and the Yemeni government forces are simply to move away from these crucial ports. But they're not actually going to put down their arms entirely. It's a ceasefire at the moment that does seem quite limited. But we do hope that all of this can be achieved, as the agreement says, within 21 days of the ceasefire actually entering into force.
Well, let's attempt optimism then and assume that it does hold for a period of weeks, perhaps even months, which means that things can go into Yemen through Hodeidah once again. What practically is that actually going to mean, certainly in the short term, of relieving the threat of starvation to many millions of people? But could this perhaps be the beginning of a wider ceasefire and the first steps towards some sort of settlement?
Yes, sharing your optimism for a moment, a ceasefire and peace has to start somewhere. So, all right, this is limited, but it is a start. And the main thing is that it will help to alleviate the starvation of, well, what the UN has called 14 million people and has revised upwards to potentially 20 million people. So opening up these three crucial ports really could help stave off the famine. It's, of course, a different step entirely to try to spread that ceasefire around Yemen and to bring actual peace to Yemen. There are all sorts of other issues that we could go into which still need to be discussed. But can I just say that I think one of the main points to come out of these talks isn't necessarily the ceasefire or the prisoner exchange or the understanding to ease tensions around another major front line, Taiz. It's the agreement to have another round of talks at the end of January. So this is a beginning.
Elizabeth Kendall, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. Here are some of the other stories we're following today. French police have shot dead the man suspected of carrying out an attack on Strasbourg's Christmas market on Tuesday, in which three people were killed and several more injured. Sherif Shekat, a known criminal and radical Islamist, was found hiding in a warehouse in the Mainau area of Strasbourg near where he lived. Early reports suggest that he opened fire on police first. Five others have now been arrested, including Shekat's parents and two of his brothers. At least nine people have been killed and 47 injured in the crash of a high-speed train in Ankara. The accident happened near Marsandiz station, about 5 kilometres from the central station of the Turkish capital. The train, which was travelling from Ankara to Konya, hit a locomotive, which was undertaking a track inspection and then an overpass. It is the second major rail disaster in Turkey in recent months. 24 people were killed in a derailment in July. And fire has gutted a depot in Kinshasa, which was housing voting machines intended for use in the Democratic Republic of Congo's upcoming presidential election. The run-up to the long-delayed vote has been marred by sporadic violence, and though no cause of this blaze has been officially announced, there does not seem to be a lot of money for the coincidence hypothesis. It is hoped that sufficient voting machines can be sourced from elsewhere in DRC to make up for what will otherwise be a major shortfall in the capital. This is the Monocle Daily. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. Earlier this week, French President Emmanuel Macron attempted to address violent protests, ostensibly inspired by his detachment from the realities of workaday life by addressing his nation on television. That he chose to do so from a heavily gilt-trimmed room in a palace from behind a desk, which Louis XIV might have thought erred towards ostentation, suggested that the lesson might not have been entirely absorbed. Indeed, President Macron is still posting approval ratings broadly comparable with those enjoyed by Louis XVI shortly before his appointment with the guillotine. Is there any way back from here? Well, I'm joined with more by the political commentator Agnès Poirier. Agnès, has his speech helped at all? How did it go over in France, especially with those not inconsiderable portions of the population who have been protesting recently?
Well, it has and it hasn't. It has in a way that just after he spoke, it was a very good address. It was pre-recorded. It was 30 minutes long. And in a way, he said all the words that were needed. And a lot of people thought, actually, a few polls were done after it. And a majority of French people, 54%, decided that although they supported still the Yellow Vest protest, they wished for the demonstrations to stop. So in a way, that was efficient. But as you mentioned in your introduction, of course, he made that speech from a very, very gold, very gilded, beautiful, extravagant by today's standards, room, one of the 375 rooms of the Elysee Palace, which is, of course, a palace that was built in the 1720s. So, he's a French president. And unless we all decide that we want the president to work from a much more modest place, this is how he's going to present himself. But you're right. There is a chasm. There is a dichotomy between the French presidency and the image that is conveyed by French presidency of the Fifth Republic since General de Gaulle, and what the entire country a massive part of the country is saying. The invisible squeezed middle. And of course, during that same week, we learned that President Macron and his wife were going to redo the carpets of the Elysee Palace. That was going to cost €300,000. So perhaps they needed, changing. But it was just not the ideal week to actually learn about this.
Indeed not. There is a narrative at large, I'm sure in France as it is elsewhere in the world, that the French people have turned on Macron, that they've changed their mind about him. But is that true? Isn't it more likely to be the case that no one really liked him all that much anyway? It's just that they liked the idea of President Le Pen an awful lot less.
Well, he has conceded a lot, actually. But and we can, of course, talk about the different measures. For instance, he has offered 100 euros more per month for anyone who earns the minimal wage, for instance. So that's almost an 8% increase. He has also offered a Christmas bonus to all employees, and the employers are not going to be paying any taxes on this. Overtime as well will not be taxed. So there's a whole series of measures. It's much more than they ever asked for. And I'm not talking, of course, of the acre tax that was cancelled 2 weeks after the movement started. But in a way, it was almost predictable that it took too long to the French government to actually realise that the deep discontent, anger, anxiety that was expressing itself with the yellow vests. And they also realized that the more violent they are, the more they get from the French government. And they have indeed called for a fifth day of unrest and to march again in Paris in 2 days' time. So we'll see, because, of course, in the meantime, we've had a terrorist attack in Strasbourg. So we'll see how it plays in favour of the French government. The police forces are extremely stretched at the moment. The level of alert for terrorist attacks has been raised to the maximum level. And Christmas is always a difficult moment because the police forces have to, and indeed the army forces, have to protect Christmas markets, but also churches. And it makes, Saturday protest, especially with the level of violence we've seen and destruction of many shops and burning cars, etc., very difficult for the authorities to actually contain.
Agnès Poirier, thank you. You're listening to The Monocle Daily. Up next, China extends its program of arresting Canadians to see how they like it.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
The Escapist takes you to places less explored. In this special edition, we hop on a hodgepodge of connecting trains to recreate the storied journey of the Orient Express from London to Istanbul. We pass by drive-through liquor stores and small desert towns on an adventurous road trip from New Orleans to Texas, and visit Europe's highest airports. For the jet-setters among you, we'll show you how to beat jet lag in cities from Hong Kong to LA and reveal our annual Travel Top 50, highlighting the best in transport and service, from the most picturesque rail journey to the airline you'll want to board for your next trip. Perhaps that next flight will deliver you to Cairo or Madeira or the island of Tsushima. We'll take you there and we'll tell you where to stay, drink and dine next time you find yourself far from home. We've even put together a wardrobe for wherever your travels may lead you, as well as an eclectic selection of books and songs to keep you entertained on the journey, when you're not too busy looking out the window spotting the places you've yet to visit. The Escapist from the editors and bureau of Monocle magazine is out now. Get your copy today or subscribe at monocle.com.
You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. China was never likely to react altogether equably to the detention in a Canadian airport of one of the country's most powerful business people, and so it has proved. Following the arrest of Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou, who is now facing extradition to the US on fraud charges, China has now lifted a second Canadian, joining former Canadian diplomat Michael Kovrig in being detained on extremely vaguely specified charges is Canadian businessman Michael Spavor. Well, I'm joined with more on this this by Rana Mitter, director of the Oxford China Centre. Rana, just for fun, I guess we should consider the question, is there any chance at all that these arrests of two Canadians in China are unrelated to the arrest of one Chinese person in Canada?
Well, it has to be said, Andrew, that Canada is a well-known international rogue nation. So there's a chance there's been some major Canadian cartel involved. But I think the likelihood is that it's just possible the two things are connected.
Yeah, I suspected as much, if I'm honest. But, you know, you kind of have to give people a bit of benefit of the doubt. That being the case, why is China arresting Canadians rather than Americans? Because, of course, the arrest in Vancouver was at the request of the United States.
It was indeed. And that shows how, how political the whole thing is. The fact is that Canada is vulnerable and the United States is far too valuable from the Chinese point of view. At the moment, China wants something from the United States that the United States does not want to give. And that is a real defined end to the trade war, which has been really ripping apart the relationship between the two countries over the last 6 months. The fact that President Trump, in fact, talked very openly in the way that he does about the possibility of resolving the trade war in return for resolving the question of the arrest of Meng Wanzhou suggests that in the American mind, or at least the mind of the American president, these two things are related. Canada is sort of collateral damage. It did do what it's supposed to do under international law, which is to extradite someone who was reasonably wanted under American law. But of course, it's much easier for the Chinese to hit back against people in Vancouver than it is people in Washington.
So is that the reaction China is hoping for here, that it's trying to force some sort of resolution to the trade war with the United States?
It's trying to do two things. First of all, it does want a resolution of the trade war with the United States, and that in a sense is a separate strand, which has been really underway for the past half year or so. But it also wants to try and avoid any sense that it's going to let its, particularly its senior business elites and its political elites, be vulnerable to international arrest of this sort. Remember what the issue was that Meng Wanzhou, the chief financial officer of Huawei, was arrested over. It wasn't, in a sense, a crime committed directly in the United States, whatever that might have been. It was about busting sanctions on Iran. And of course, China is by no means the only country in the world that thinks it may not actually be that legitimate for the United States to go around arresting people from third countries because they do business with a country that the United States doesn't like. In this particular case, China, which of course is very dependent on Iran, amongst other things, for energy, it does not want to put itself in a situation where doing any business with that country attracts the wrath of the United States. So it's trying to send out warning signals now. And in a sense, that's related to, but separate from, the central question of tariffs and tax impositions that relate to the direct trade war.
What options does Canada therefore have at this point, especially if China seeks to reinforce its point by rounding up further Canadian citizens?
Indeed. Well, I think one of the things it could clearly do is to try behind the scenes both to pressure the United States and indeed Canada to get this case resolved as quickly as possible, presumably with the release of Meng Wanzhou. It could also try, of course, to push on historical links. It is a fact that Canada recognized the United States rather earlier than, Canada recognized China rather earlier than the United States in the era of the Cold War. And even today, young Chinese are taught that one of the most famous Westerners, at least from a Chinese point of view, was a man called Norman Bethune, a Canadian missionary who actually worked under Chairman Mao when Mao was out in the countryside during World War II. So there are bonds of friendship between the two countries, Canada and China, that are actually rather longer than the ones between the US and China. But on the other hand, that would really be, in a sense, pushing on the emotional buttons to make that work in this particular crisis situation.
I mean, you call it a crisis, but are we anywhere near the point at which, say, Canada might have to think about telling its citizens in China, of whom I'm sure at any given moment there are many thousands, that it might be a good idea to come home?
I think it would have to be heightened well beyond what we're at now. On the other hand, I'll be honest, I was slightly surprised when I heard that these mutual arrests of Michael Spavor and Michael Kovrig had actually been ordered by the Chinese side. I would have thought the Chinese would have wanted to kind of lower the temperature, but in this case, it looks like they're going to DEFCON 2 or 3, if not necessarily DEFCON 1, fairly quickly on. So if this escalates, then it may not be so much a question of coming home, but perhaps watching out for, say, things being thrown in the street or demonstrations against Canada. At the moment, if you look at the Chinese press, this story is huge. It's very, very much on the front pages. And the Chinese wider population, both through the press and social media, are being encouraged to look at Canada with an extremely jaundiced eye. So if you're a Canadian in China at the moment, you may be feeling a little more vulnerable than you would have been a week or so ago.
But by making such a big thing of it, is China not obliging itself, therefore, to make some sort of production with these two Canadians they've arrested? Or will it look like enough if they're both just given a bit of a wigging and then put on a plane?
I think that would probably be enough, essentially the kind of getting them to confess their sins and then deporting them. But I think that I suspect that what the calculation is on the Chinese side is that by going very, very hard, very early on in this, they will send a very clear message in any future occasions when, say, a prominent Chinese is up for extradition from Canada, that the Canadian authorities should think more than once about whether they're going to do it or not. The fact matters because there is such a large Canadian population in Canada itself. Sometimes the city of Vancouver has been nicknamed Hongkouver because there have been so many well-off elite Chinese actually buying property, setting down roots, sending their kids to school there. Canada is generally regarded as a relatively migrant-friendly, prosperous and stable country, and China likes being, Chinese elites like being involved with it. But this particular incident has set a bit of a chill up the spine, and that's why I think that Beijing has maybe reacted as strongly as it has within the first couple of days.
Rana Mitta, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. You're listening to the Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Muller. Reports that North and South Korean soldiers have crossed the demilitarized zone into each other's territory would, at many points in the last 65 years, have prompted widespread scrambling for the nearest cellar, and would, if we're honest, have been much closer to the top of the program. But exactly such expeditions have been mounted for the first time ever and have resulted in the exchange only of handshakes. As part of the recent thawing in relations between Pyongyang and Seoul, some DMZ guard posts are being dismantled, and it's a process being monitored by troops from both sides. Well, I'm joined now with more on this by Lynn O'Donnell, freelance journalist and the AP's former bureau chief in Afghanistan, also a former foreign correspondent with a focus on North Korea. Lynn, the pictures are great, as I'm sure everybody involved knew they were going to be. It is the whole Christmas 1914 football match no man's land scenario. And that's no small thing in itself, you know, pictures of, you know, handshakes being exchanged by North and South Korean soldiers. That aside, how big a deal is this?
I do think that it's quite historic. Like you say, it's never happened before. And for both sides to have entered into a thaw to such an extent that they are actually blowing up and dismantling some of the guard points along the demilitarized zone, I think we can greet that as a big deal, yeah.
You do have to hope that all the troops in the DMZ were warned well in advance that things were going to be blowing up.
Yeah, well, indeed. I was in North Korea with the Australian former foreign minister Alexander Downer when he went in about 2000. And I was with a number of Australian correspondents. I was the Beijing correspondent for the Australian newspaper at the time. And we were sitting down at dinner, and one of the guys asked one of our fixers, why was it that in the 70s, North Korea very abruptly broke off diplomatic relations with Australia after only 1 year? And He said that the line of sight from the south on the demilitarized zone through to the north was obscured by a tree. And one of the American soldiers crossed into the DMZ, which is essentially no man's land, with an axe, and he was cutting down the tree. And the North Koreans were so incensed, they sent soldiers in who grabbed the axe and hacked him to death with it. And when they looked at the axe later, it said made in Australia. So that was Australia's role in this incident on the demilitarised zone, and they cut off relations with Australia. Only later did they have another look at the axe and see that it said made in Austria. But by then, the fix said it was too late.
Well, that is an illustration of how tense an environment this has been for many decades. And I guess in the context of the misleadingly named demilitarized zone, the removal of a dozen or so guard posts, it's not that big a deal. But these things do have to start somewhere. And are we seeing the beginnings of something here?
Well, we could be. It's been quite a year, really, for the Korean Peninsula. The South Korean President Moon Jae-in went to Pyongyang, as we know, earlier this year. And Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, met with Donald Trump, the US president, in Singapore in June. And that in itself was historical. And an agreement came out of it, which was quite vague and a bit blurry, but which Mr. Trump said was an indication that Kim Jong-un was willing to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula. And that in itself is a big deal, because for many years now, the North Koreans have been what was secretly, but recently become more open, building a nuclear arsenal with the aim of, well, they say that they can already reach the continental United States. They regard Japan as an intransigent enemy. And so this has really been one of the most destabilizing points in the world for quite some years. So a thawing in any way it might be, is a very good thing, yeah.
I mean, you mentioned President Trump there, who will, of course, claim any credit that might be going anyway. But in this particular instance, where Korea is concerned, does he actually deserve any?
Well, you know, I'm not going to say that he doesn't deserve any at all, but it doesn't seem to me that any of the seriousness that the American administration has regarded North Korea with over the past decade and a half or so, well, more than, well, for 50 years, has really been dissipated. Because just last week we saw sanctions imposed by the United States on senior Workers' Party officials in North Korea, and that was in relation to what the Americans said was their human rights violations. So they're keeping the pressure on. And while the North Koreans reacted very vocally about the sanctions, what these basically means that these guys can't go to America, Americans can't do business with them. And while that sounds like it's a little bit of a misnomer, there is big business being done by very powerful and connected people in North Korea by way of buying the loyalty of the army and the party. Some of them are allowed to have enormously lucrative mining and fishing and export concessions, for instance. So this could be quite meaningful. And as I was saying, while North Korea is blustering about it, it could be an indication that they are willing to trade their nuclear arsenal for a peace deal. Because I think what the North Koreans, what Kim Jong-un wants to do is concentrate more on developing his country economically, and maybe the nuclear weapons can be sacrificed in that cause.
Lynn O'Donnell, thank you. We'll have more from you later in the show, looking at some of the Asian and Australasian newspapers. You're listening to The Monocle Daily. Do stay tuned. On On this week's edition of The Menu, we are off to Italy. Millions of visitors flock to Florence each year for the city's wealth of art and architecture, yet it's often the food that leaves the most lasting impression. For those eager to learn more about the culinary arts, one cooking school is taking a relaxed approach to introducing people to the region's gastronomic riches. Set inside an elegant home interior shop, Desinare uses a friendly, hands-on methods to get participants involved in making everything from homemade pasta to cakes. Monocle's Milan correspondent Ivan Cavaglio went to Florence to sit in on a session to learn more.
Located on the south side of the Arno, near the Boboli Gardens, Desinare is a world away from the tourist crowds flocking central Florence. Opened in 2014, the cooking school is hidden away upstairs inside Riccardo Bartel, a family-run furniture business best known for designing custom kitchens. Up a flight of stairs, owner Francesco Bartel greets guests in a private dining room and kitchen where small groups gather for Desinare's cooking courses.
E quindi l'idea di avere una cucina, una scuola di cucina all'interno del
Bartel explains that the idea behind his school is to recreate an informal atmosphere where people come and learn around the dinner table about food in an atmosphere that is convivial and not overly didactic. The school's name, Desinare, reinforces this concept. In the Florentine dialect, the word refers to the main meal of the day, typically lunch, when families would gather to eat and catch up with each other. The school aims to recreate a family gathering. Today, Chef Maria Valiani is taking her guests, an American couple from Seattle, out to do the morning shopping to get ingredients for today's lunch menu. Handmade tagliatelle with a porcini mushroom sauce, and arista, a Tuscan-style roast pork. First, she drops in to see the neighborhood butcher.
Buongiorno. Allora, noi abbiamo bisogno di un po' di...
Today we will prepare some pork loin. So it's typical Tuscan meat, a piece of pork with a bone. We will prepare sage and rosemary together. We will make a massage to the meat and then tie back to the bone and cook in the oven for an hour with a little white wine. That's it.
Next up on Valiani's list is the vegetable vendor for seasonal produce for the pasta sauce.
Here we will look for some fresh porcini, Tuscan one. They're beginning the season, so those are really good. And some mushrooms that grows close to the trees. We call them little pioppini. It's the Italian name.
Back in Desinare's kitchen, Valiani, herself an expert sommelier, opens a bottle of wine to lighten the mood.
Use wine while cooking. You can sip some wine, you can use it for cooking. The best thing is there should be a rule. The wine that you are drinking should be the same wine that you use for cooking. But sometimes it's a waste because you are drinking a very expensive wine, so you don't want to waste it for cooking. So I suggest to drink a good wine and use the younger but same grapes for cooking.
Desinare's easygoing approach is a hit with foreign and local attendees. Hands-on activities include making fresh pasta from scratch.
Okay,
you can use your fingers. Yeah.
To make a volcano in
to
the,
make a larger volcano.
Okay.
Yes.
Is that
a
good?
Big hole. Okay. Could be a kind of a dam.
Okay, like this?
Yes. Okay.
Now the egg.
So the egg has to be broken on your chopping board and then pour inside.
So now I crack the egg and I put it in the flour for the pasta.
Yes, inside the hole. Oh. Yeah.
Throughout the preparation, Valiani doles out advice. For example, how to get the most from the mushroom sauce, including not wasting the boiled water used to make pasta.
You will see that the sauce is too dry, but you will see that from the water where we boil the pasta to the sauce, we will use some of this water. And it gives the creamy that we need. So the starch from the pasta will make the cream that we need, we look for.
After preparing the dishes and eating them, Valiani reflects on what makes the school work so well.
It's really a cozy place, a place where people, even that come from the opposite part of the world, feel at home. It's very a familiar place. We speak about cuisine, we cook, we learn, we decide to change the recipes. For example, we go to the market, somebody do not want leeks but onions, so we decide to change the recipes. So it's very familiar and people enjoy also to come back after years. We keep in touch.
With its cozy kitchen space set for no more than 10 people, Desinari's approach has been a hit, attracting year-round interest and providing yet another reason to visit the Renaissance capital. For Monocle, in Florence, I'm Ivan Carvalho.
And for more food and drink stories, tune in to this week's edition of The Menu on Monocle 24. It premieres tomorrow at 1900 London time. You can, of course, catch up with that and all our other programming anytime you like on our website. This is The Monocle Daily.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
The biggest names in art, culture, politics, design and more are back for a sensational eighth season of The Big Interview on Monocle 24. Hear our editors in conversation with people whose stories, secrets and successes are sure to inspire. From a record-breaking artist...
I mean, there were a lot of fascinating things about art school. Now, we were kids, but every now and then you would pass by a room and somebody would come out the door and you would look in there. You would see there were naked people in there.
To a global leader fighting climate change.
Democracy is complex and messy, but it's a much more responsive and safe system. And we have to understand that we need now to defend much more vigorously the values that we took for granted.
And there's more. The godmother of new wave cinema, an investigative journalist and best-selling authors are among the inspiring voices you'll hear on The Big Interview. Tune in every Sunday at 9 a.m. London time, anytime as podcasts, or better still, subscribe so you never miss an episode. The Big Interview on Monocle 24.
Time now on The Daily to take a look at the Asian and indeed Australasian newspapers. We're joined once again by Lynn O'Donnell, freelance journalist and the Associated Press's former bureau chief in Afghanistan. We start with the New Zealand Herald. This is a it's a very weird and very of our time follow-up story to the story of Grace Mullane, this ghastly tale of this poor British backpacker who has been murdered in New Zealand. As a result of that, New Zealand might end up putting Google in the dock as well.
Well, so it seems. But it looks to me like the fundamental to this story, I think, is a real lack of care by the people at Google in New Zealand. What's happened is that the man who's been charged with Grace's murder has appeared in court, and he applied, his lawyer applied for him to have his name kept out of the public realm. Mm. And even though the judge in the case refused that application, the lawyer for the charged man immediately appealed. And under New Zealand law, that appeal gives him privacy or anonymity from the public for 20 working days, so effectively a month. So what that means is that his name can't be reported by any media outlet. But what's happened is that Google, in its What's Trending in New Zealand list, put the name of the man out there on the internet. And so it was picked up by a number of newspapers, and especially in the United Kingdom, where Grace is from, a number of newspapers ran it. And the New Zealand government has been really quite strenuous in its complaints about media outlets using the name of the guy who's charged with Grace's murder. And many of them say that they have removed his name from their websites. But just this evening, it took me 32 seconds, if that, to find the guy's name.
And doubtless that will be the case for anybody in New Zealand who's interested as well. Moving along to the Sydney Morning Herald, this is a report of a speaking tour being undertaken of our mutual homeland by Malala Yousafzai, the 2014 Nobel Peace Laureate. She does seem extremely fond of Australia. She seems to be enjoying herself there, but she's not been altogether uncritical. And the Australian media, I think it's safe to say, is not famous for regarding criticism by visiting foreigners with equable good temper.
Well, indeed. But Malala has a lot going for her. She's an extraordinary young woman. She's 21. She was a supreme advocate for girls' education in a part of Pakistan where she's from called Swat, where the Pakistani Taliban holds sway. And because she was writing an anonymous blog on the BBC website from memory, and it became known that she was the one who was doing it, and a gunman got on the bus that she was on going to school with her classmates and shot her in the head. And extraordinarily, she survived. She came to the United Kingdom and she was given treatment, and she goes to school at Cambridge, I think, and she won, as you say, the 2014 Nobel Peace Prize. She's a global superstar and she's a great advocate for girls' education, and she is, as you say, visiting Australia. She's got a book coming out there in a little while called We Are Displaced, and it's about refugees. And so even though she has been greeted very warmly and she has praised the warmth and the welcome of Australian people, she's criticised the immigration policies of the Australian government. And as you say, the Australian media is not very friendly to people who criticise the country. But in this case, her criticism has gelled with the criticism that the Australian media has been waging against the immigration policies for a long time, because there are still people who are being held on Nauru and Manus Island in terrible conditions and almost in secret for quite a long time. And this, these inhumane conditions are what have riled Malala, and rightly so.
This is a running sore in Australian political discourse, obviously, but do you think it's leaving aside the rights and wrongs of the extremely hostile environment extended to boat-borne refugees, is it just also poor reputation management on Australia's behalf? Because as Malala Yousafzai acknowledges, Australia actually does, leaving that aside, does pretty well as a country taking in refugees through legitimate processes. Is that something Australia has just allowed to slip from the global consciousness, do you think?
Well, quite possibly, but if you might remember that there were an awful lot of refugee boats coming to Australia up until a few years ago. And it was really quite unnerving for the Australian population, I think, because there was a feeling that control of immigration had slipped away, and snakeheads and people traffickers and were taking enormous amounts of money from people clearly in destitute situations who wanted to come to Australia and seek asylum and safety and get away from the awful conditions. And I think one of the things that Manus Island and Papua detention camps sent, the message that they sent to people was that this is not a nice place to come to. And so it's been in double magnitude. People have stopped coming because the snakeheads have been found out. But the conditions that people are being held in order to send a message to others not to come, are appalling. And so, yeah, bad management, but also bad treatment of desperate people.
Lynn O'Donnell, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. You are listening to The Monocle Daily, and finally tonight, underpinning much modern popular culture is a kind of nostalgic yearning for a time when popular music was perceived as upsetting and subversive, rather than, as it now usually is, something that presidents and prime ministers are desperately keen to associate themselves with. There might therefore seem some reason to be jealous of the hip-hop artists of Russia, but the repression they are starting to attract is as real as it is ridiculous. Rappers are increasingly finding their concerts cancelled, their videos blocked, and themselves arrested. Well, earlier on Midori House, I discussed this with The Independent and Guardian columnist Mary Dejevsky and The New York Times global economic correspondent Peter Goodman. I began by asking Mary why the Kremlin might be worried about Russian youngsters getting into hip-hop.
Well, I think the first thing I'd say, just in response to what you've said, I would say all that is true except minus the Kremlin. Because when you look at all these reports and everything that's been happening about banning concerts and sort of locking up and detaining rap artists and hip-hop artists and goodness knows who else, when you look at the geography of it, it's sort of around the province, the big provincial cities of Russia. So far as I could see, it hasn't touched Moscow and it hasn't touched St. Petersburg. The biggest cases, the most prominent cases, have been in places like Krasnodar and Rostov in the south. And this said to me that there was at least, that there were two possibilities. One of them was that it was local officials getting above themselves and thinking that this was the policy. And the other one was that it was a sort of tryout, maybe, from the Kremlin to see how effective or it could be to try and suppress this sort of stuff and whether the methods would be effective. Now, the second part of this story is that there seems to have been a sequel come down actually from the Kremlin to say, hey, lay off this, which is very peculiar because that is exactly the message you wouldn't expect, because the problem has been, as you said, that the lyrics have become increasingly politicized and increasingly sort of suspect in the sense of what used to be called in the bad old Soviet days socialist morality. So sex, drugs, and all the rest of it. So it's hard to divine where the Kremlin actually stands on this. Yes, the material is sensitive. Yes, some of it challenges politically, some of it challenges socially. But it seems that the Kremlin has now gone into reverse position and sent down instructions to the deep provinces to say, well, maybe this is not what we should be doing.
It may therefore just be, Peter, a story of small-town police chiefs not understanding these weird rocking sounds of the kids. It's Footloose again, isn't it? It's becoming the film that's explaining literally everything.
Two Footloose references in one show. That is incredible.
I haven't seen the remake, so I don't know if those were germane to the reincarnated Footloose. Right.
The fact, I mean, look, we don't know what the answer is to that good question that Mary's teeing up, but I think it's fair to assume that if people in control, either at the center or the local level, are viewing these rappers as a threat, that's a sign of weakness. I mean, the reign of Vladimir Putin has been all about building up the nationalist aspiration, again, projecting Russian power, hearkening back to the days when Russia was feared and respected. That's all about, you know, outward positions, going and taking the Crimea, running the proxy war in the eastern Ukraine, projecting power into Syria. But meanwhile, you have large numbers of people, especially young people who are unemployed. You have infrastructure crumbling. You have education falling behind the rest of the world. And we live in the age of the internet. So plenty of people in Russia understand Russia's position in the world. And we've seen this movie before. When people want to dissent in a place where there isn't freedom and where there's risk, it's the artists who usually find, you know, coded ways of expressing their grievances and their unhappiness with the center. And clearly some people in positions of authority get that and see in these rappers something potentially dangerous.
I think that the wrapping, and especially the political wrap, I mean, it's always very, very interesting to watch and to listen to the words and see what they pick on. And some of the things that they're picking on are inequality, privilege, some of the very similar things, in fact, as there were in the last years of the Soviet Union. But I think there's another aspect too, which in some ways brings it closer to what some of what we're seeing, at least in London and Britain, which is that at least some of the bans seem to relate to, there have been two recent rather American-style shootings in Russia, one of them in the south and one of them actually in the far north. And it seems that some of this attempt to suppress things is because they see it as related to youth culture and that sort of music. And of course, when you look at, there's been a whole hue and cry in London over the rise in deaths by stabbing and the relationship that some draw between youth violence and what's called drill music. And so what we've had here has been the Metropolitan Police coming out and saying that they think there ought to be much tighter restrictions on things like drill music and people who do drill music and certain types of heavy metal and all that sort of thing. So the idea of, as it were, relating these things and trying to clamp down on the one in order to try and prevent the other, you know, it's not unique to Russia. We're seeing it here too. And it's very tempting.
Mary Dejewski and Peter Goodman speaking to me earlier, and that is it for today's edition of The Daily. It was produced by Daniel Bache and Tom Hall. The researchers were Daphne Karnesis and Martha Libri. Our studio manager was David Stevens. The Globalist is here 8 hours from now with Emma Nelson. I'm back with The Daily at the same time tomorrow, playing us out and keeping it Russian hip-hop. This is Husky with Polyadora. I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks very much for listening.
Панельного не по краю. Еду по России, не доеду до конца. Еду по России, не доеду до конца. Еду по России, не доеду до конца. Где панельку моего отца? Подветрилась свадебная мимоза. Все панельные драмы, как трамфареты. Улыбка лисадина ниже.